Much is said of the value of experience, of how veterans of many battles learn such tricks and see an enemy's moves so often that eventually they develop a second sight and can almost predict and anticipate what he will do next. All this is of course true, but it is not the entire story. All of this supposes that a foe is aiming to kill you, but that he will choose tactics designed to maximise his own chance of surviving the battle whilst doing so. What Samlin did not know was, Aiden was certainly trying to kill him, but was not bothered if he survived or not. Samlin advanced on Aiden, swinging his sword in an arc, bracing his shield and taking the time to study his opponent to learn his weakness. But Aiden did not give him the time. He just charged. Samlin took a few moments to react, and when he did, he now had to bring his sword back from being held out to his side. He managed it all right, but with the blade moving so quickly, he could not direct it with any accuracy. Aiden groaned in pain as the sword sliced into his left shoulder, opening a blood vessel which let out a gush of blood. His arm just went limp, and he dropped the shield. The next instant, his momentum had carried him onwards into Samlin, and the collision sent him into his enemy's arms, in a bizarre parody of lovers embracing. They stood like that for a long moment, and then, suddenly, Samlin vomited up blood and fell backwards with a loud crash onto the ground, quite dead. Aiden's sword was slick with blood from impaling one eye, and he held it high in the sky and gave out a cry of vengeance justified. "Charge!" my father yelled, and started towards the Welsh, followed a moment later by the rest of our men. The Welsh, still stunned by Samlin's death, stood in shock silence, and we cut them down. There was to be no mercy or pity, because we now recognised each one of them. These were Elmete, who had raided the villa, alongside One Eye, and watched him kill Cuthwin, and the others whose relatives were in the company, and who today avenged their death. These warriors at least died quickly on our spears and swords. Then it was done, and Hussa alone stood beside Mildreth. My sister started crying as she ran over to me, and I held her as she sobbed away her fear and as she realised that she was free again. Father joined us now, and I could see that his own eyes were moist. He reached out and pulled Mildreth and I towards him, and then the three of us stood together, holding each other for a full 5 minutes. All this time the brooding figure of Hussa looked on impassively at this family he was not part of, but perhaps should have been. Mildreth was laughing now. "If I ever try and sneak a look at a warrior again, just hit me, all right, Curdick?" she said at last, reminding me that it was curiosity that had got her into all of this. I nodded, and then tilted my head at Cuthbert and Aiden, who stood nearby. "I think there are two here who you won't mind seeing." Both Cuthbert and Aiden came across. Cuthbert gave a shy smile, and Mildreth put one hand gently on his cheek. Aiden suddenly groaned in apparent pain. "Oh, my poor dear, let me see to that," Mildreth said, moving his hand away to examine the wound, and then tearing a strip from her own dress to bind it. Aiden grinned, and out of sight of my sister he rolled his eyes at Cuthbert, who glared back at him. So, not all our battles were over, I realised, and idly pondered what the outcome of that little skirmish would be. Chuckling to myself, I turned away to look at Hussa. Hussa had dropped his sword and held out his arms.
"Go on, father. Kill me too."
Father just walked up to him and slapped him hard across the face.
"Bastard traitor," he snarled.
Hussa wiped the blood away from his lip and glowered back at father.
"Yes, and as I once said to Curdick, we all know who's bastard, don't we?"
Again he held his arms away from his chest.
"Just finish it now. My mother is dead, and soon I will be, and you return home as the hero who saved Dara."
My father looked down at the sacks he was carrying, back up at Hussa, and then dropped the long knife and shook his head. "No, I will not. Enough have died today. Besides which, your life is in the king's hands now. You are coming with us, son," he said, and Hussa was led away. Father bent down and picked up Hussa's sword, the sword I had coveted through my childhood and youth, Then he wandered over to Samlin's body and retrieved his brother's sword from the ground and wiped Aidan's blood off it onto the grass. He then turned and offered them both to me.
Take one of these, son. You have earned it.
I stared at the blades. But, father, that sword is yours.
No. It was my brother's. He died a warrior and a hero. Today, I would give it to you. For this day, it is you who are the hero.
My hand shook slightly as I reached out and grasped the hilt. My fingers tightened and I took my uncle's blade, the blade of a warrior lord. I held it up so that it reflected the lingering sunlight. Then I glanced across at the other sword, Husser's sword, which I had always wanted to own. Each was a magnificent, glorious weapon in its own way. I studied them both for a moment. Then I shook my head and passed my uncle's blade back to my father. He looked at me curiously, puzzled at what I was doing.
Keep that sword, father. It has always been uncle's, and then yours. Give the other to Aidan, if you would take my advice, for I already have a sword.
I once heard it said that every good story is about a sword. Well, that may be true, but I now realize that every good sword has its own story. I reached down and drew my own blade, the broad, sharp stabbing weapon that, Lila told me, was in fact Roman. It was a gladius, and once would have been wielded by a legionary posted to the fortress of Calcarea, and later was carried by the armies of Samlin as they attacked my home. It was there that I took it from the first man I killed. I carried it to Calcarea and used it to free our people. Finally, here, at this battle, it was the weapon that killed Owain, the Golden King of Rheged. I now held it high so every man could see it. I will call it Catraeth, in memory of this place, so if I ever have to draw it in battle again, I will not forget those who died here. One of the men had retrieved the wolf's head banner and proudly carried it back to us. The Wixton Company had its standard again, so it was time to return to the camp with it. That left just one thing, the amber treasure. Bending over, I examined Samnon's bloody corpse. His one eye stared at me, but he no longer burnt with his hatred and evil, and I did not fear it. Inside his tunic I found what I was looking for, all of my mother's jewellery, save the link from the one earring, which I knew Husser had sold. It is over, I said, handing them over to my father. He examined them briefly and then thrust them inside his own tunic.
No, he said, not quite over. There is still one more duty.
Then he turned away before I could ask him what he meant. The sun was setting as we walked back towards Stanwick camp. We were alive, and quietly I gave thanks to the gods. Today I had not been fated to die. Around me lay 1,500 men who had not been so lucky. We believe that when we die, if we die as warriors, we go to feast in Woden's hall with the men we have killed, now our friends. I looked at Edward, Cuthbert, and lastly Aidan, walking along one hand clamped to his wounded shoulder, and smiled. Woden's hall could wait, for now I was glad to share a few more days with my friends, right here, right now. Soon after we reached the army, the celebrations began. Ethelric welcomed Ethelfrith into Stanwick camp, and in the fortress a victory feast was held. I sensed that we had been present at one of the great battles, a turning point perhaps in the history of our troubled land, and indeed we had. There would be no further attempt by the Welsh to cross the Pennines for a generation. Their hopes of driving us into the sea were finally defeated, and it had been this battle that planted the dream of a common race north of the Humber. The dark times of division between us, which would plague much of my life, were part of an unknown future. Naive of what fate was destined to shower upon us, we drank ourselves senseless in joy. Bernicians and Darens celebrated the truth. We were not just Saxons or Angles any longer. We were Northumbrians. Chapter 18. Husser. The following morning I woke early and, needing fresh air and to empty my bladder, left the hall where I had slept and walked to the battlements to watch the sunrise. I was now utterly sick of this place of death, and I turned my gaze southwards towards the bridge, Ere Forwick, and the even more distant villa. I did not get my wish immediately, of course. That day, and all of the next, we finished burying or burning the dead. Our wounded needed rest and treatment for their injuries, whilst the able-bodied turned our efforts to repairing the camp's walls for defence against a possible further attack, although one never came. We seemed to be delaying our departure home for no reason that I could discern, but we found out why the following day. Ethelric and Ethelfrith had been involved in long discussions. Harold, Sabbat, and the other commanders were often seen coming and going into the hall which the two leaders had taken over. Harold in particular looked furious one night when he came out, but when I asked him why, he would not answer. There was great secrecy about the subject of their discussions, but rumours will emerge eventually in any army. Some said that Ethelfrith was keen to invade Reged and conquer it, taking advantage of its weakness, but that our prince did not want to. Alfred from the Wolds swore that he had seen Owen still alive after the battle, walking away from it. I knew this was nonsense, of course, and I told him that I had killed the Golden King with my sword and knew he was dead. But in the chaos of battle, men can imagine many things. Indeed, one day a tale went around that Eorforwic had indeed fallen to an uprising, and that we were about to march there to put the city to the sword. In the end, we discovered that the issue under discussion was the future of Stanwick Camp and the location of the border between Bernicia and Deira. We were shocked, but I guess not surprised, to find out that Ethelric had agreed that this border should lie at Catraith Bridge, a few miles south of the fortress we were in. In other words, Stanwick Camp would be left in the hands of Ethelfrith. So, this had meant that we had marched all the way here and fought a battle. Darren blood had been shed, Wallace and hundreds more besides him killed, and after all of that, we were simply just giving away the fortress. Suddenly the feeling of unity and the dreams of Northumbrian brotherhood seemed foolish. The Bernicians started ordering us Darrens around, acting all self-important, as if they were the masters and we were their subjects. One of Ethelfrith's house guards called Edward a piece of shit, and my friend got into a fight with him and broke his nose. Relations in the camp grew tense, and soon even worse, and fights broke out on a daily basis. One man from the Wolds was killed by two Bernicians, but Ethelfrith would not permit them to stand trial, which made us even angrier. It now started to seem as if a battle might be fought between the former allies on the same battlefield where they had defeated the Welsh only a couple of weeks previously. In the end, though, Ethelric called all the lords and commanders in the Deiran army to him. He looked frankly exhausted and seemed to struggle to get his words out, and when he did speak, there was a tone of resignation in his voice. "You see, it's simple numbers," Ethelric explained to us. "We have just 500 men to defend Deira from future Welsh attacks. Ethelfrith has 1,000 spears. He can keep a few companies here and still fight on against the Welsh to his west and north, whereas we would be stretched manning a garrison all the way up here. In addition, there are the armies of Elmet, which might come again and attack us one day from the west. We were victorious here," and now he swept his arm around in a circle, "at Catraith, because we had allies, but we would not be able to defend our own homelands if we kept 200 men here. Bernicia is better placed to watch over Reged and the pass and release us to guard our western border. I don't like it, and I expect you won't either, but there's nothing else to be done." And so, that was that. The treaty was agreed. The prince was correct that Nonindera would much like it, but we could see Ethelric's point, I guess. The victory here had saved Deira from an invasion by the Welsh, but we had now given away Stanwick Camp to the more powerful Bernicians, and so many of us questioned the outcome. Had it justified the death of all those who had died? Would Wallace feel that his sacrifice had been worthwhile? Would the families in Wixton and elsewhere, those whose sons would never go home, find solace in the outcome? Well, to those questions, I had no answer. There was now nothing to keep us here, and with tempers frayed and relations cooling, Ethelric ordered the army to be ready to march the next day. No one complained of that. Ethelfrith came out that last morning and spoke to Ethelric. Then, the King of Bernicia turned and looked over at us, and I found that I did not like that expression one bit. To me, he seemed like a man assessing our strengths and abilities. This man, and his father, had been heroes to us all when we were growing up, I had always imagined him full of courage and valour, and he certainly had all that. His eyes, however, told a different story. They showed ambition, as well as a lust for wealth, land and power. For the moment, he had been our saviour, and our lands were, as a result, safe. But as we marched away, I thought to myself that a man such as that was a dangerous ally, and I pondered that it would be all too easy for him to become our enemy. Then I cursed myself for wasting time with these thoughts. It's not your problem, Kurdik, I thought. Enjoy the moment. After all, we are going home. We did not go straight home, of course. We marched with Harald to Ir Forwick, and there discovered that Ayla had arrived and set up camp in Harald's hall. Ayla held a feast to celebrate victory at Catraeth and to give thanks for our survival. Then, the next day, he summoned a great council, to which I was invited. Lila was too, of course, but excused himself, saying that he had been invited to play at a special celebration in one of his favourite halls, and would see us later. The rest of us sat down to discuss the campaign. Ethelric talked of the battle, and then the negotiations with Benicia. Frowning as he heard about the treaty, Ayla reluctantly agreed to the arrangement, realising that he had really no choice. But I got the feeling that he wished he had been there, and seeing the expressions on the faces of the nobles, I think many of them felt this too, for we knew that he would have put up a bigger fight than his son did. Then Ayla called my father and me forward, and we stood side by side in front of him.
"It's time for some reordering of my realm," he said. "Lord Kenred, your action in persuading Ethelred to come to our aid saved the army at Catraeth, and, as a result, our land. Lord Wallace died bravely saving my son, and I honour his memory. But now Wixton needs a new master. Wallace left no heir, so, to you, Kenred of the Villa, I grant the estates at Wixton and the title of Lord of the South Marches."
My father must have known this was likely, because he did not act surprised, but like me, gawping at my father like an idiot. "Thank you, my lord. I am honoured," father said in a hoarse voice, and I could tell that the often gruff man was touched.
"Kurdik, son of Kenred of the Villa, I have heard the words of Lord Harald and Sabbat, who have sung your praises."
I looked at Sabbat in surprise, and Ayla saw the glance and smiled.
"In particular, Lord Sabbat has said that it was your insistence that you stay, and your unfaltering faith in your father's arrival that saved the army. More than that, your defence of the gate at Stanwick Camp at the critical moment of the slaying of Owen enabled the Benicians to join a battle, rather than have to fight Owen's army after he had slaughtered you all."
I nodded at Sabbat, and for the first time he smiled at me.
"So, it is with great pleasure, and with your father's permission, that I grant you the title of Lord of the Villa, under your father's overlordship."
My head span at the news. I was a lord now. Was it that many days since I was, more or less, a farm boy? I was unable to find a word to say, so I just bowed. As I came back up, my father placed a hand on my shoulder. "You make me proud, son. Cuthwin would have been so too." How my life would have been different if Cuthwin had lived. Would he have taken command of the company in Elmet? Would it have been he who had fought Owen at the gates of the fortress of Catraeth? Then, would it have been he standing here in front of the king, confirmed as the new lord of the villa? At that moment I realised that I would give up all these triumphs and pass the glory to him, if only he was alive today.
"Now," Ayla went on, his voice suddenly stern, "there is one more matter we must attend to."
I was not surprised when Hussa was led out, his wrists bound tightly behind his back. One of Ayla's houseguards pushed him down, and he was made to kneel in front of the king. Ayla then called my father to give account of all that Hussa had done, and went on to summon other witnesses who confirmed that Hussa had been seen alongside Owen and Samlin, and was in fact Samlin's trusted lieutenant. Finally, the king turned to my half-brother.
"Have you anything to say in defence before I pass judgment?"
Hussa just glared at him and said nothing.
You understand that you stand accused of treason, and that the penalty for betraying your country is death?
Hussa spat on the ground at the king's feet.
My country? He asked. What has my country done for me? I had more honour and reward in Elmet than in the service of Owen and Samlin than it ever had here. Here I was just an unrecognised bastard son, whilst there I was a lord.
Part of me could understand how appealing that must have been. To have left behind the past full of anger and rejection, and taken on a new life would have seemed intoxicating. Yet, almost 2,000 people had died these last few weeks. How much of that blood was on Hussa's hands, I thought.
Very well. I judge that you are guilty of treason and will be executed by hanging. Your body is to be left to rot in the open as a warning to others.
As Ayla declared his fate, Hussa visibly paled, but still stared defiantly back at the king. In the hall there was now utter silence. Then, next to me, my father stirred. He glanced at me, then he moved forward to stand beside Hussa. I stared at him, wondering what he was doing.
Sire, I wish to claim the right to pay weregeld for this man, in lieu of his punishment.
The lords in the hall gawped at my father. They, like me, shocked by this unexpected statement. From the expression on his face, Hussa was as stunned as the rest of us, and just stared in confusion at his father, the father that had never recognised him, the father who had rejected him and who thought him a traitor, and now the father that stood by him, a condemned man guilty of treachery. What did my father hope to achieve? Sabbat coughed, breaking the silence.
Kenred, why do you do this? What is this man to you?
Father did not hesitate to answer. Until now, only a few men knew, or had realised, that Hussa was his son. Of the lords of Dera, only Wallace had been aware. Now, he chose to confess to them all the full truth.
Hussa is my son, he said simply.
Sabbat's eyes went up in complete surprise. Harold's expression was that of a man who had just heard the answer to a riddle, and now realised that he really knew it all along. Ayla, on the other hand, showed no reaction. Had he known it after all? Or was he just very good at hiding his reactions? My father looked at the king and spoke again.
His mother and I had a brief relationship one summer 17 years ago. She was beautiful, and I was weak. It was intense, for as long as it lasted. But then I realised it could not go on. In the end I had to choose between my wife and the family I had made with her and Hussa. Now I realise this was the wrong choice. I should not have been made to choose between them. I should have recognised Hussa years ago. Then things would have been different.
Ayla sighed.
A man makes his own choices, Lord Kenred. Hussa made his, and nothing that you say excuses what he has done.
Perhaps that is so, sire. But he is still my son.
Ayla nodded.
Weregeld, though, it's for murder, theft, and so on. The law and our customs do not allow it for treason.
Weregeld was blood money. If a man killed or harmed another or caused damage to property, he could prevent punishment by compensating the victim. Our kings defined, in various codes of law, how much it all cost, and the lords then enforced it. But, as Ayla said, treason was never included in those lists.
The king decrees the law, sire. You can decide if it may be included, and if so, how much?
Sabbat spoke again.
Kenred, even if the king chose to allow this, how can you value the safety of a kingdom? How do you define its worth?
Ayla nodded.
Lord Sabbat speaks truthfully, Lord Kenred. To dissuade offenders, the fine must match the crime. It would be a fine of the order of thousands of shillings.
But you will allow that the kingdom needs such money at this time, to repair the damage of the war, and to rearm and equip the Fjord, my father suggested, and Ayla nodded.
There is no denying that.
Then, for treachery to a kingdom, I offer, as weregeld, a kingdom's treasure. With a flourish, he pulled out my mother's jewellery. Ayla looked at it and pursed his lips, staring at the amber treasure for a long time before speaking.
I once gave that to your brother as a reward for saving the kingdom, he said at last.
Then, let me give it back in payment for his nephew's wrongdoing, my father answered.
Ayla was silent again, but this time his eyes were not focused upon the jewellery, but somewhere else, and just as on the day of the great council in his own hall weeks before, he seemed to be thinking back over the years to another war, another battle. Finally he nodded.
So be it, but I will not permit a traitor to remain in my kingdom. Hussa, I commute your sentence to exile from Dara during my lifetime. My heirs will decide if that sentence prevails after my death. You will leave Dara within 2 days. If after that time you are found within its bounds, you will be declared an outlaw, and any man can kill you lawfully.
Hussa was shaking now, and seemed to be a mix of conflicting emotions. He was staring at Father as if he did not know what to make of him.
You may escort your son to the border, Ayla said softly. This council session is ended.
I went to join my father, but he shook his head and then held up his hand, bringing me to a halt. Wait here for me, he said, and then turned away, glanced at Hussa, and pointed at the door. Hussa shuffled that way, escorted by 2 warriors and followed by my father. At the door he turned and looked at me for a moment, and then nodded briefly, just the once. What did that look mean? Was it an apology? Or was it a threat that the next time we met I would not be so fortunate? Then he was gone, and I was left staring at the door, not sure if what had happened was right or wrong. Right for Father, perhaps, but maybe wrong for everyone else. Ayla passed me and glanced at my face.
Don't blame yourself, Lord Kurnick. For Hussa, I mean. A man makes his own choices, and he has made his. You and your father have served me well, and I am sure you have many future battles to prove your worth, he foretold.
So there it was, a prediction about my future, Kurdic as a warrior lord. There was a time when Lila's poems had set my soul aflame, when all I dreamed of was the glories of battle, and of winning a name and land, of slaying the kingdom's enemies, and becoming a hero of the sagas. As I thought back upon them, I realized they were not visions I shared any more. No, the last few weeks events had changed all that. If I was honest, I had been terrified when we got into battle. A lot of young men from both sides had died on Catraith Field. Only a few days before, they had been alive and probably full of the same dreams I had. Like them, my dreams had died, and I had simpler ones now. Now it seemed that a hero's heart did not beat within my chest, and I realized that all I really wanted to do was to return home and settle down to domestic life. Whatever Ayla said, I believed my fighting days were over. It was time to go home to the villa, to my family, and I thought tentatively to Edith. Father and Hussa had departed Ierforwick within minutes of leaving the council. They had ridden north out of the city and up Dare Street. Father was gone for a couple of days, and when he did return, all he would say is he had seen my brother to the border at Catraith, where Hussa crossed the bridge. Of what they spoke of on the way, or how they had parted, he never said a word. When he did return, he clapped me on the shoulder, and I could see the tension finally draining from him. Now it is at last over, he said with a smile. Let's go home. Yes, it was over, and the next day it was time to go home. Firstly, we went as far as Wixton with the rest of the company. Now the cost of the war came home and showed itself in the anguished sobs of mothers who had lost sons, wives who had lost husbands. In all, of the 85 who had belonged to the Wixton Company, 60 still lived, though many were badly wounded. 25, including Wallace, were dead, and those losses hurt the small town and all the villages around it. Numbed by the deaths, and exhausted by the weeks of raids and war, there was relief rather than joy over the victory. So it was, with polite acceptance rather than celebration, that the townsfolk welcomed Father as the new lord of Wixton. I think we were all glad that there was no suggestion of feasts or days of ceremony. We stayed just one night in Wixton, then Father summoned the villagers, Mildreth and I, for the final journey home. As Father led us down the road from Wixton, we came over the last rise and could see the villa and the village. He stopped for a moment, then laughed out loud, and I realized it was the first time I had heard him laugh since my brother had died. We all halted and looked at the sight that greeted us, and I felt my heart suddenly fill with joy, for there, ahead of us, was the little world I was born into. Those fields, woods, and cluster of buildings were so familiar to me that they were like parts of my body. Now, after all the blood and horror, Here it was at last, home. We were home. Father had sent word ahead of our coming, so Mother had learnt of our return a day before, and the villagers had hurled themselves into frantic preparation. The last of the spring blossom were all used up in great garlands decorating the barn. A bonfire roared on the ground outside it, and strips of bright cloth streamed from all the huts. We rushed down the path towards the barn, but when we arrived we were surprised to see no one. In fact, the entire settlement seemed deserted. Then I heard a giggle from one of the village children hiding in the barn, and a moment later the doors were flung open, and all the village women and children burst out laughing and smiling. Suniva almost knocked me over as she hugged me, then she rushed on to embrace Mildred. Mother was just behind her, laughing and crying at the same time. Mildred came back, and moving past me, she surprised Cuthbert with a kiss on his cheek. My friend went red with embarrassment. He glanced to see if this had been noticed and saw Edward and me watching him intently, grinning like idiots, as well as Aidan, whose face was wrinkled into a puzzled frown. Then I felt someone kiss my own cheek, and I turned to see Edith standing there, her hair braided with ribbons and wearing a dazzling yellow gown, and looking simply stunning. "Welcome home, Curdick," she whispered. I could find nothing to say and just stood there, nodding stupidly. Suddenly in the barn music could be heard, a jaunty little tune played on a lyre. We all went in and found that it was Lila playing. The smile on my father's face at that moment was priceless. "I thought you said you had to play for a feast in your favourite hall," Father said to him. "Yes, well, I do get so very bored at councils. Besides which, Rodwin sent a message to me asking that I be here when you arrived, and I decided to come early and practice. This is, after all, my favourite hall," Lila said, gesturing with his hand at the barn. My father beamed and reached across and pulled my mother to his side. Then, laughing, he waved us all into the barn for the feast. To all men, just like nations, there are golden times, moments that, for all their lives, they will think back to as an ideal. To some, it will be their earliest memory. To others, it is times of their glories and triumphs, and others still, their first love. For me, looking back through the haze of the long years, through the times of sorrow and hardship, it was nights such as these, filled with joy and music and surrounded by the friends and family whom I loved, that were my golden times. Of course, I may be a little biased, for on the night of the great feast, Edith found me after we had all drunk far too much mead and ale. She had listened with a mixture of horror and pride at Lila's tales of my battles, and even though I denied most of what he said, it was clear to her that I could so easily have died, and that I might have been one of those poor souls who now lay beneath the soil of Cattraeth Field. That night, she took me to a dark corner of the hayloft behind the great barn, from where laughter and music could still be heard coming through the night air. Then, having both learnt just how fragile life was, feeling a desperate need to simply enjoy the moment, and with any inhibitions relieved by the mead, she pulled me down on her, and, it has to be said, that I offered no resistance. A few weeks before, the last spring of our childhood had ended with a night of horror and blood that made the children we were into man and woman. This summer night ended in warmth and pleasure, and we celebrated the fact we were alive and young, by giving ourselves to each other. All my life I had wanted to become a warrior, inspired as I had been by the poems of Lila and the stories about my uncle. Yet, my dreams of glory had turned into the blood and ashes of a battlefield. I realised that I did not find joy in the fighting or the victory. Rather, it had all seemed horrific beyond words. I still honoured my uncle, but I had been glad to get home. And I now assume that I was destined to become a farmer. I believe that I could live out my life in obscurity, farming the land and filling my free hours with Edith's company. Looking back from old age, when the faith of Christ had replaced the old religions of my fathers, I can recall many times when my friends and I appeared to be at the whims of powers beyond our understanding. Today, we talk of the will of God. In those far-off days, it was the machinations of the gods, or a man's weird or fate, that affected his destiny. A man prayed to the gods, put his trust in fate, and life would go well, unless, of course, he was fey, unless he had been chosen or doomed to follow some other path. You know, I'm not entirely sure I agree with all that. It implies that nothing we do has any effect, that in the end we are all merely pieces on the game board of the gods, just pawns pushed around by Loki. I will accept that most folk just live and die with little impact on and little affected by the world around them. But some of us, at least, are more than that. We become part of the world, help to shape it and mould it. You can tell we lived because the world changed whilst we were alive. Whatever the truth, the will of man, the plans of the gods, or the chances of fate, I was a fool to believe that the world had finished with me just yet. No, Loki had not cleared away my piece from the board. Not me, nor my friends Cuthbert, Aidan and Edward, nor the bard Lila or the teacher Grettir, all were still in play, as were Ethelfrith and Ayla. Then Loki laughed and put one more piece on the board. His name was Hussa, and he was still in the game. The end. You can find out more about the Amber Treasure on my website, www.richarddenning.co.uk. There you can discover how to download the book in ebook format, as well as find out where you can buy it as a paperback. In addition, there are competitions to win copies of the book, as well as my blog, The Anglo-Saxon Survival Guide. See you there. Soundtrack used on Amber Treasure is Rondo Polska by Barry Phillips. Hi, this is Richard Denning. If you enjoyed The Amber Treasure, why not check out my other titles, The Last Seal and Tomorrow's Guardian. Both of them are available via my website, richarddenning.co.uk. See you there.